Today on the Dolby Institute podcast, we're talking about what producers are looking for when they're searching for new creative voices. So if you're an aspiring filmmaker, screenwriter, or director, or any of the above earlier in your career, this episode is for you. And when I say we're talking about producers, what I mean is we're talking to producers, and some incredible ones at that. Today's all-star panel includes Christina Oh, the producer of Minari, Poppy Hanks, the executive producer of Judas and the Black Messiah, Michael Gottwald, producer of Beasts of the Southern Wild, Andrew Hevia, producer of Moonlight, and finally, the president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences herself, Janet Yang, who's produced such films as The Joy Luck Club and Over the Moon. This is all part of our series of satellite sessions, conversations that we're bringing to you in partnership with Anti-Gravity Academy and the Coalition of Asian Pacifics in Entertainment. Like our previous satellite session, this was a live webinar hosted by our very good friend, former Dolby Institute Fellowship winner and Academy Award nominated director himself, Carlos Lopez Estrada. We are once again extremely proud to bring this conversation to you, filled with real world advice for navigating the film industry as an emerging filmmaker. Take it away, Carlos.
Thank you so much for tuning into our satellite session, Producers Searching for New Voices. My name is Rianne, and I am the Programs Manager of CAPE, the Coalition of Asian Pacifics in Entertainment. CAPE is the nonprofit organization creating opportunities for Asian and Pacific Islanders behind and in front of the camera. You can learn more about our work and learn more about us at capeusa.org or at capeusa on social media. We are incredibly excited to partner with Carlos and his team at Anti-Gravity Academy, as well as Dolby Institute. Carlos and his team have done a phenomenal job, basically recruiting all of these incredible producers, as well as their the voices that they're able to offer. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to hand it to Carlos.
Thank you so much, Rayland. And thank you all of you for joining. So many of you, incredible. We've been excited about all of these conversations, but I think this particular one is kind of surreal. And you'll learn soon why. The people joining us are just incredible producers. So anyway, thank you all for joining. My name is Carlos Lopez Estrada. I'm a filmmaker, founder of Anti-Gravity Academy. We're a production company established last year with the main focus of supporting emerging filmmakers in film and TV and beyond. So in addition to hosting these monthly conversations such as this one, we're going to be launching many other initiatives soon. We're going to have some mentorship opportunities. We're going to have an incubator for first-time filmmakers. So please make sure you follow us on Instagram at Anti-Gravity Academy and stay connected to learn more about what we do. About these satellite sessions, what you're here to see and to hear today, these are free monthly conversations with amazing figures from the film and the TV universe. Our first few panels featured conversations with directors speaking about their first feature, as well as agents describing their process, finding new voices. And all of these conversations, including the one today, will be available soon in podcast and video form through the amazing Dolby Institute channel. So stay tuned for when and how you can access these. Please tell your friends about it. We have one next month and so on. We are wanting to build the largest community of emerging filmmakers on the planet, and we really appreciate all of you showing up. So, okay, about our panel today. As we all know, every one of these groundbreaking films ever made would not really be possible without the involvement of a key figure, which is a producer. And that's because producers are instrumental in finding and amplifying artists' voices, championing all these stories that deserve to be told. Today, we are joined by five exceptional, truly game-changing producers who who will share a little bit about their process, searching for new filmmaking voices, and developing and shepherding their stories for the screen. So please welcome Christina Oh. She's an Academy Award nominated producer whose credits include Bong Joon-ho's Okja, Joe Talbot's feature debut, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, a movie that I love dearly. She more recently produced Minari, written and directed by Lee Isaac Chung, and nominated for the Academy Award for Best Picture. Next, we have Poppy Hanks. She is the Executive Vice President of Film Production and Development at Macro. Poppy, executive produced a six-time Academy Award nominated Judas and the Black Messiah, also an amazing movie, directed by Shaka King, Fences, directed by Denzel Washington, and the multi-Oscar nominated Mudbound, directed by Dee Reese. Next, we have Michael Gottwald, who's coming at us live from Italy. I think it's like 3 a.m. He produced Beasts of the Southern Wild, directed by Ben Zeitlin, which was nominated for 4 Academy Awards and won top awards at Sundance and Cannes. He also produced Jeremy Jasper's debut feature, Patty Cakes, and has collaborated on multiple projects with Bill and Turner Ross. Andrew Hevia, the head of TV and film in North American office of Fabula, the international production company founded by Academy Award winning filmmakers Juan de Dios and Pablo Larraín. His credits include Moonlight, Cenizas, and Spencer. And last but certainly not least, Janet Yang, who is an Emmy and Golden Globe Award winning producer. Janet is also the president of the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts and Sciences. She was the president all last year, and today she's been reelected for a new term. So congratulations, Janet. Her extensive producing credits include the Joy Luck Club and the Academy Award nominated Over the Moon, as well as collaborations with Steven Spielberg and Oliver Stone. So I hope now you understand why this panel is so crazy exciting to all of us. And we're so happy that so many of you have shown up. And just so you know, the way we're going to do this, we're going to have some questions for our panelists. We're going to have a little bit over an hour long conversation, and then we're going to open it up to questions from you all. So if there's any thoughts or things that you would like our panelists to talk about, please make sure that you write them in the chat. And when the time is right, we'll come back to them and share it with them. Thank you all again for taking time from your busy, busy lives and Tuesday nights. In your case, Michael, I think Wednesday mornings for joining us. I'll throw an icebreaker question. And if you all would want to answer, that'd be amazing. What was the moment, if you remember the moment in your life, when something clicked and you realized that you wanted to produce movies?
I think that I have a controversial answer, which is I don't think I ever had that moment, because I don't think I ever really understood what it meant until I was already apparently doing it. It wasn't like this is what producing is, and oh, I like it. You know what I mean? I think it was, I came from supporting and wanting to work on, I went to a college where there was a film major, and I decided very quickly, I knew I didn't want to be a director, but I just really liked the work of other people in my class and some of my friends. And I just wanted to work on their stuff. And then I've kind of realized after the fact that if you just keep working on their stuff and doing whatever needs doing, you are actually like, that is what being a producer is at the end of the day, at its most basic. And so that's what I don't know. So I don't know if I ever had a realization moment. It's just sort of like, I kept doing it. And then I realized like, this is what it is. And so I had already been doing it. I wish it was a cleaner, like light bulb story, but that's what
there's no formula here.
I think I would agree with that. I actually went to school for screenwriting. I was in the screenwriting program at SC, and my friend was making music videos and a movie. So I was like, okay, I'm going to help you do your thing. You'll help me do my thing. We'll help our other friend do their thing. And we're all going to do this thing. And so got that general experience. And as I was making my way in the development world, it just kind of organically led to that path. So there wasn't a like, bam, it was more like, how the hell I get here? What was a left-hand turn kind of thing?
I had a big bang. It was a total bam for me because I grew up not even imagining I could work in the film industry. It never occurred to me. I never saw anybody that looked like me who did anything in front of or behind the camera. I didn't think that we had any possibility of doing anything creative at all. So, and that's partially because of my generation and partially because I grew up in a totally white neighborhood. And I just hadn't a clue. It was on the East Coast, hadn't a clue. I went to live in China after college just because I became very, very curious about my parents' birthplace. And it was while I was there that I saw for the first time movies and television shows with people who looked like me. And that's what got me interested in film. I had always been interested in watching, but it got me interested in doing something. And I started distributing films from China. And then I had this opportunity to work because of my previous work in China. I had the opportunity to work with Steven Spielberg and Kathy Kennedy on the movie Empire of the Sun, which shot in Shanghai. And that's when I thought, oh, this is what I want to do. So
that was your first experience?
That was my first real experience because I had no background. I didn't go to film school. It never occurred to me. I went from distributing Chinese films and then bringing American films to China. And I had this office at Universal, and I was essentially in distribution. And then they asked me, I was literally the only person in Hollywood at the time that was going back and forth to China. It was not a popular thing to do or even think about. And then I got hired on this production. And then I saw what went on behind the scenes. And I was like, aha.
What a wild way to
be pretty wild into the pack, film right?
world. Amazing. Christina, I'll pass it over to you.
I mean, I don't know how to top that, but I do think it's, wonderful people like Janet sort of paved the way. I'm from Massachusetts. I think I saw some people saying they're from Mass. Woo. I too was like, when you're a kid and you watch a movie, there's hundreds and hundreds of names that come after the credits, but you don't really watch them. And when I got older, I was like, I don't know, this movie thing kind of sounds cool, but I don't know if there's a career in it. And then I sort of went to college and was like, oh yeah, there's all these people that are involved. Maybe I could explore that. So I wanted to be a doctor, Asian. My parents were really excited about that. But ultimately I was like, I'll apply to the film school. If I get in, I'll do that. And it was a producing focused major. So I did that and sort of kind of, kind of like Michael was saying, like, didn't really know what, but I learned a lot. And then I came out to intern in LA and quickly figured out what they do. And it seemed really cool as somebody who, I love the creative aspect of filmmaking and I love story and developing stuff, but I cannot write. I commend all the writers. They are so great and brilliant. There's so many great ones out there. I was like, I don't need to add like a very subpar writer to the group. I kind of was like, directing doesn't seem my thing either. But I was interested in everything and casting and every other process that goes into filmmaking and was kind of like, oh, as a producer, you kind of get to be involved in all that and help shape production in that way. So I kind of just stuck with it. And then of course landed at Plan B and learned from the best and kind of realized how important and how influential, but also how supportive you can be in a production. And that's kind of what stuck.
And Andrew, your origin story.
My origin story is, I think, in three parts. When I was really young, I remember the moment I learned that movies were made and didn't just spontaneously like come into being. And it was the first time I saw storyboards and I realized like, oh, this is a process. People get, they make them this way. And I became really interested in figuring out that process. And as I went to film school, I went to Florida State, which is a very production focused program. And I became very interested in the machinery, you know, how the project comes together. And I kept trying to find ways to go upstream to answer the question, like, how did this all start? Like, I understand how you get hired on a job to work a production, but how does a production come into being? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until after I graduated film school that I was trying to find sort of my place. And I realized I was surrounded by filmmakers who all wanted to be filmmakers and all needed producers. Like, it was the question everyone was asking, who's going to produce? And I realized, like, oh, wait, I could probably do that. And then all the phone calls were incoming. Then it was the filmmakers that I knew saying, like, you're doing that? Great. I need that guy. So all of a sudden there was a volume of work and I had to figure out how to navigate it. But it almost felt like whatever traits or interests I have, other people had to tell me, like, oh, those are skills that we're looking for. Can you come here and help me do that? And I got invited onto projects that I realized the real opportunity was working with filmmakers that I love and admire, and I get to work with all of them. I get to find, you know, a point of view and say, I can help on that project. But then there's another one completely opposed in style and tone, whatever, but I can go help that one also. So I get to continue my sort of exploration of how these things come into being, which has sort of been my trajectory from the beginning. But project to project, learning every way, you know, how to be a part of it.
Amazing. I think we're also thankful that y'all answered your calling, because you brought incredible stories into the world. Okay, question. All of you had great success in discovering powerful and new filmmaking voices and developing their work. I know that there's no one way, there's no formula that you follow, but how have you gone about finding these artists? Is it through festivals? Is it through relationships, through talent agencies? Like, what do you feel has been, if there are any constants in terms of how you've been paired up with your directing collaborators?
I can jump in. I got lucky because after I worked on that big production, then I was the production executive at Universal, but working with Amblin. So I saw, and Kathy Kennedy was just starting to develop more projects. So I was getting a feel for what it really meant to be a producer. And then I really preferred being on set. So I joined Oliver Stone, and he just gave me a lot of leeway. And I said, well, Oliver, what kind of movies do you want to make? You know, what budget level, what genre? And he just kept saying ad hoc, which I took to mean just find things that you love. That's how I interpreted it. So, you know, I think it depends on, in that situation, I had a lot of freedom, and I had sort of an 800-pound gorilla behind me. So the projects that were being sent to me, they're rarely from agents at the time, festivals. It was really people who knew of our company. And I found myself immediately attracted to films about people of color. It didn't have a name then. This is back in the late 80s and 90s. We didn't talk about diversity and inclusion then, but I was attracted to that. So my first film was called South Central, and the second was called Zebra Head, and then later came Driller Club. But it all just happened purely from instinct. And there was, again, these days we have a lot of vocabulary words for what we're trying to do, you know, diversity, inclusion, et cetera, et cetera. Believe it or not, those vocabulary words were not spoken at the time. But I thought, oh, well, here's a story from a perspective that hasn't been told before. So I just found, and they were mostly right. There was a company that doesn't exist anymore, bless them, Columbia TriStar Home Video. And they just gave us $3 million for those first two movies because they knew they could, they didn't have stars. They were just really interesting scripts, and they knew they could sell them on the home video market after a theatrical release. So it was a completely different time then. And then later I did, you know, many studio films where there were very interesting stories and voices that were, again, not a franchise variety, and it was a different time. I feel very lucky to have worked at that time where you could find really great original voices. I think it might have become harder in this day and age, but so it was literally without having to think too much about, oh, where, what's the profile or what's the marketing behind it. It's a little bit perhaps the way that A24 works now, which is they go by instinct, by creative instincts, and they just find filmmakers that they love. I had that opportunity back in the day.
In terms of finding collaborators, I would say it's heavy on the agency side. It's all in terms of submissions, whether it be from general meetings or tracking films that we love, and certainly from the festivals for sure. Us doing Blue Bayou, we were at Sundance trying to sell Mudbound and having a hell of a time trying to sell it. And I was in the audience for Gook. I grew up in LA in the 90s and it was about the riots. And I was like, I gotta go check this out. This is Korean American filmmaker. I need to know who he is. So it was a little bit targeted. And I saw the movie and it blew me away. And I made a beeline for Justin when the credits rolled up, but then my phone was blowing up and it was Charles King telling me to go. Ted Sarandos wanted to go see the movie. And so I had to abort, pivot. I didn't get to meet Justin, but quickly upon returning home, set up a meeting and had a really great meeting with Justin. It's also about like vibe and vision. And he talked about wanting to do a movie about adoption, specifically foreign adoption and specifically more so Korean adoption. And we were intrigued and excited and like, let's go, let's do it. And it just quickly led to what became Blue Bayou in a couple of years after development.
Yeah, just a beautiful movie.
Thank you.
Poppy said it, and I do turn to agents and, you know, go to the festivals. And I do think though, the one thing is, if you grow up, so to speak, in the industry, you do make a lot of assistant friends and exec friends. And as you get older, and people start to get have a little bit more power at their companies, like Last Black Man was one of my dear friends who was an agent at CAA, was like, I have this short, you need to see it. It's at Sundance. And I kind of was like, oh, okay. And I'll like, you know, he's a good friend of mine. So I was like, I'll put it at the top of the list. So I saw Joe Talbot's American Paradise. And I think the cool thing is, like, you know, you watch something and for me, it's very instinctual thing. It's definitely like, ooh, I see something in this and I want to know more and I want to explore more. So that's definitely a path through the agencies and friends that work in the industry and executives and managers. The other thing is, I don't know, I'm a little nerdy and I do go like, I do sometimes go down like a shorts or YouTube or whatever rabbit hole. And kind of like, I love watching the shorts at the festivals too, because I do think there's a lot of, you know, financing is something that's very prohibitive for people who are very talented, but maybe they just don't have the finances to make a feature or, yeah, you know, get something off the ground, but they can make a 5 to 20 minute thing that, you know, gets into a festival. So I do love spending time watching that. So that's something that I love to explore. And, you know, book scouts and book agents, we read a lot of IP. But yeah, that's kind of probably primarily where, and then sort of relationships you build through the filmmaking process over the years.
Andrew, Michael, in whichever order you prefer.
I was just going to say, I don't think it's funny to hear. I don't think agents, I think because our company doesn't, like, we never have any money to finance anything. The way that I've come into it has been very different. It's just been more, and I never did the like LA, like working at those places at agencies or in production companies where you have this very like concerted network of people who will do things like that. I've been jealous of it, honestly, because I think that is a really great way to kind of like, oh man, you got to see this short. And then you end up talking to the director. I've just been like, I just try to see as much stuff as possible and then just reach out to people when something seems just like really great. But a lot of it is has of course been like, you work with one director, that director knows this other person, says you guys should, you know, you should talk. You then meet that person, you realize you love their work and you want to work with them. And then it's just stuff like, you know, anything that makes your world smaller, I think, in this industry is super helpful. So like you go to, you know, you go to like a festival or a Sundance or a Gotham or a IFP thing where you're just meeting up with people. And even if you don't like necessarily start working together, then you might end up circling back and working, like reconnecting like 4 years later or something. And then you're working on something together. So I think anything that makes the world of this industry a little bit smaller and a little bit more manageable and a little bit more one-on-one, and that's driven by your own taste can be a great way to find collaborators, basically.
Yeah. Andrew, I'll pass it over to you lastly.
I would say my experience and background is actually much more similar to Michael's. I didn't come up in LA. I moved here only 5 years ago. And so don't have that same network, and have always found my opportunities and my filmmakers outside of it. And I think there are sort of several paths, but specifically focus on new filmmakers and new voices. One of my favorite things has always been to try to find a way to make the world a little smaller. As Michael said, like make it more manageable, because I always felt that the system was always stacked against you. There were always people who were better connected, who were better funded, who knew more people, who had better access. And one very good example of something very recently is a couple of years ago, probably about 5 years ago, as I was leaving Miami, working with an arts organization in Miami that's a very well-funded arts organization, I helped start a micro-budget filmmaker residency. And that residency gives out a $50,000 grant to a local filmmaker to produce a full feature for that money. And we picked that number very specifically because, you know, Barry Jenkins made Medicine for Melancholy for like under $20,000. Amy Simons made Sun Don't Shine for you know, under $50,000. And even Kelly Reichardt made River of Grass in Miami for not that much money way back when she made it. So there was an understanding that you can make incredible things with that amount of money. It's a certain type of movie. In my experience, you can showcase all that you need to showcase as a filmmaker for a smaller movie. You don't need big things to show that you're creative and find interesting ways to tell a story. So with that program, we've now given out probably 5 or 6 grants. Monica Sorrell just did a film that came through that program called Mountains that just won an award at Tribeca. It was her first feature. And, you know, before that, Edson Jean had a film that played South by during COVID. Farron Humes is making a movie. Chris Molina just finished one. Like, we're working with young filmmakers who are making that first step into features. And it's been a really exciting way to see the process and sort of use some of the, now I can use some of the relationships that I am building to help these filmmakers as they progress in their careers.
Amazing. And Andrew, just because I'm seeing the chat and everyone's asking, can you share the name of the, is it an organization or is it a program?
Yeah, so it's, here, I'll write it. Oolite Arts is the name of the program, and someone else jumped in with it.
Right there.
Yeah, but that it's specific for Miami filmmakers. You have to live in Miami to participate. But if you do, by all means, our open call will starting again later in the year.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, as you probably already figured out by now, most of our community who's here, so many people, by the way, it's emerging filmmakers. So it's people who are, you know, maybe have a little experience trying to break into the industry. Some of them, you know, fresh into this world. But would you, and this is for whoever wants to answer, would you have any tricks or tips or words of wisdom for an emerging filmmaker listening to this panel and wondering how they could potentially go about finding a producing collaborator? And I think you've answered a lot of this, you know, through festivals, but if you don't have a film in a festival, if you, you know, did not go through the agency system in LA, what do you think could be like some proactive steps that a filmmaker could do to just like try, you know, shoot a line out trying to find a producing collaborator?
Making a great short film is of course an amazing way to start. And so much information is available online to try to find people whose tastes align with yours And, you know, you may have to start as an assistant or even intern or whatever, but you need to build a network. And sooner or later, I've had assistants that went on to work in rooms that went on to whatever, whatever, you know, it's, you have to build a stepping stone of relationships. And, but in the meantime, work on your own projects. I think it's really hard, but if you make a fantastic short film, whether or not it's at a festival and you send it around, people will notice. I know I have, to Christina's point, you know, that's a, it's the best way of showing that you, you know, have the talent. Having there are also a lot of script competitions. I started one with Cape, in fact, for Asian women and non-binary people. And there are a lot of other competitions out there. There's funding for short films, and there are a lot of diversity programs. So you just have to do a lot of scouring and just inform yourself as best you can of who might be an ally and supporter of yours.
I think that's super smart. Another reason why to do this short film is that you might end up coming to understand that somebody in your own network would actually be a great producer, like would be a great producer for you anyway. They might already be there. They might be your supporter, the person who's like helping you make that short film. I hesitate to get to have people to recommend that people think about producers as gatekeepers, because it they're like, that's not necessarily really what you need or is the most important thing out of a producer. What you need out of a producer is somebody who's just going to like work tirelessly to move your to get your movie made and move it forward. They don't have, like, it's not necessarily like they have some magic keys to the kingdom or castle or something like that. I think if you find somebody who just works their ass off and believes in you, that is way more valuable than them having produced a bunch of other movies or whatever. So yeah, that's just a thing I like to tell people.
If you're a student, if you're still in film school or college, I know that sometimes there's student films that you guys make together. I did one in college, and we would collaborate for each other, whether it was like you're the caterer or the grip or the producer or, you know, the AD. You kind of like learn the jobs as you're doing them. And there, you will always find there's like a handful of kids that you're like, that guy's going to be a producer. He's so like type A or whatever. And, you know, I think you can kind of build a relationship there if you don't have the means yet to quite make a short film or whatever that will get into a festival. As Janet said too, I do believe there are some resources out there, whether it's through the guild, there's a producing guild. I think they're still figuring a lot of things out as things move along, but they are very, I do believe they have a program and they're very passionate about pairing young up and coming filmmakers with established producers in a sort of one-on-one mentorship program. Might not be popular for me to say this, but I also think it doesn't always work. And I will admit that I'm not always the best at this, but I do have random people sometimes reach out to me just asking for advice or whatever. And I know it's a little scary nowadays. I mean, I do think the world has made it very difficult for people to help each other out, because you just never know, you know, with everything that goes on nowadays, like what somebody will do by reaching out to you. But there have been a couple cases where, you know, I did receive like a very heartfelt email and did spend like 10 minutes on the phone with somebody to try and give some advice or lead them towards a mentorship program or some other resource. But I think primarily what Michael and Janet said are really great. Like you can find some programs and try and make a short, try and showcase your abilities.
Well, just speaking about working with first time filmmakers, you know, as a producer, I know that it's a big risk and a big gamble to work with someone who has never made a movie for, you know, a number of reasons. What have you all found are the greatest challenges and the greatest opportunities when working with someone who's never made a movie? And how do you know, I imagine it's instinctual, just something that you feel, but how do you know when you read a script, when you see the work of a director, that they're ready, that you're like, what makes you feel like you can make that gamble and you can take that risk. That was like a 10-part question, but let's see if anyone wants to jump in.
I think I can speak to kind of what it is about them that makes you want to take the risk. I think the pros and cons and that I don't even know if we have time for that, but I've worked with a lot of first-time filmmakers, and I think it comes down to, it is a feeling, but it's also the way the filmmaker speaks about the project, what their connection to the project is, how prepared they are, and all of the things that lead me to believe that they are the one to tell this story. And no one else can tell the story. Like, this is theirs to tell. I had a meeting with a filmmaker who shall remain nameless, but I got his short. And it's always going to come down to those shorts, guys. Just know that. And there was an agency who was trying to sign him based on the short, and he was getting this buzz. Which, of course, if someone ever tells me, like, you got to do this thing, I'm like, I'm totally not doing that thing. But they, you know, were really insistent, just meet him. And I was like, fine, I'll just meet him and I'm going to pass. That way I can pass. And I go to the meeting, and I hadn't watched the short yet. And he asked me if I would watch the short with him sitting there, which is also very awkward. But what I thought was going to be
that's a funny way to watch a short, yeah.
You watch me watching the short. But what I thought was going to be a 30-minute meeting ended up being a 2-hour meeting. And based on the visuals that I saw, the way he spoke about the content, his personal relationship, how he wanted to shoot it. And when I came out of the meeting, I was like, yeah, I guess we're joining this movie. We got to do it. So I'm leaving him nameless because he doesn't know that.
Yeah, I really agree with Poppy, though. It's like you're basically not just selling a story, you're selling yourself.
And 100%.
You want to be someone that people have confidence in and that you want to be in business with, someone who feels collaborative, is just someone you want to hang out with. You end up spending so much time together if you are making a film together. It's so that person who has a real sense of surety about the story can speak about it very articulately, have thought of all the issues, all the questions that might come up already and prepared to talk about them. I mean, that's huge. Just that, having that level of confidence and, you know, the ability to communicate, I think is absolutely huge.
We did a panel with our very first panel was with agents talking about similarly how they find new clients and emerging filmmakers, and they gave the same answer, which was just like having great work is just the very, very first step, but even more important than the work is just what the filmmaker has to say, how they carry themselves, how they communicate their ideas. And just making sure they have a really strong reason for wanting to do the things that they're doing. So it's reassuring to hear you both say that again.
Wait, well, Andrew, it can be hard if you're not used to presenting yourself that way. And, you know, there's some people are better, you know, in the moment, or, you know, writing, or, you know, what have you. I will say, conversely, I had a first-time director who was a pretty like established writer who wanted to direct one of their pieces. And my meeting with this person had me like, hell no. Like, I'm just, no. This is, he wasn't speaking as a director at all. I wanted to set it up on some sticks and let the actors do their thing. And I just felt like they weren't ready, you know, and appreciated it. But that was a leap I couldn't take.
Yeah, Andrew, it sounded like you leaned in as if you were going to say something.
I agree with what's been said. I think Poppy and Janet both talked about the preparation. If you meet someone who understands what they're bringing to the table and you feel like they're the only person who can tell that story, that's the job, right? It's like, can you convince other people that this is the way it's going to be? Can you work with people? Can you be You know, can you speak with conviction on your project in a way that's compelling? I think is one of the biggest tasks. If you can do that, then it matters a little less if you've done it before. If you've done it before, it's easier, obviously.
So let me ask you all this, and again, whoever wants to answer. Once you dive in and you're in it with your director, what are your general philosophies in terms of the role you play in helping, and whether it's a first-time director or not, but in helping your directors find success? Like, what do you think is the most successful version of your role as a producer collaborating with the director?
I have an answer for this. I don't even remember where I heard this. Somebody smarter than me said this line, but they said that as a producer, every movie needs you in a completely unique way. And it's your job to figure out how this movie needs you. And I think that's kind of been the mission. You meet a filmmaker, you figure out what it is that they need support on, and then you support there. And if it's super hands-off, they got it, great, happy. I've got other projects that need more. And keeping that philosophy in mind, that every movie needs you in its own unique way, is sort of what allows me to be flexible and adaptable to the situation.
Yeah, totally agree. It's like putting together puzzle pieces. And you never know. You know, I've worked with multiple Academy Award winning directors, I've worked with first time directors and everything in between. And every situation is different. So it's really about being able to read the room, so to speak, in this case, not just the room, but the whole situation, and knowing, you know, different strategies for how to work with different directors and for the rest of the cast and crew for that matter. There's a level of flexibility and sort of making it up on the spot, because you're constantly, it is, no matter how many times you've produced a film or television or whatever, there's always new challenges. So being very flexible. And then there's some things that you can carry with you, you know, again and again. For instance, how you treat people, the tone that you set, you know, the level of respect that you have, or how to empower a director without looking like you're interfering too much or whatever. You know, there's certain things that you can carry throughout, but often it's really like any relationship that you have in your life, it's a different dynamic.
Also, as much as everyone's talking about like, oh, you have to sit, you know, you meet with them and kind of like how you interact or how the meeting goes sometimes tells you whether you want to work with this person or not. I do also think that, look, I can only really control myself, right? I can only change myself. I can't change anyone else. And it's often also myself recognizing I've had to pass on things where I've read it and it was so interesting, but I realized I shouldn't be the person that's like shepherding this. Like, there's somebody that I think is better suited to produce or shepherd this story. And that's like sometimes a hard decision to make, because, you know, sometimes you just want to do it all, but you have to also kind of, what everyone's been saying, be the, like, a hard part is like, can I be additive to this process and create space for a director to sort of, or a filmmaker, whomever is involved, to really get the best out of what they're going to be able to give. But yes, I do think primarily though, it is, does this person have a point of view, and do I like the script or the short or whatever I've been given? It's very difficult. Rarely do I read something and I'm like, that was a shitty script, but I'm gonna like want to do this project with this person. I don't know. Sometimes you do read something and you see a lot of potential, and you're like, oh, if this person's a writer director, maybe we can do some developing. But other times it's, I do think primarily often it's like, oh, is the outline or the script or the source material or whatever you were given, is that really strong? And then you meet with them sometimes and you're like, this person's amazing or has a vision, or is, maybe I'm not the right person for this.
I just want to point out there's some interesting questions, sorry, in the chat, beginning with what exactly does a producer do? I wonder if we have to backtrack. And they're like, what do you mean by development? I'm wondering if this conversation needs to go simplified slightly.
That would be amazing.
Really new.
I was just oddly enough brought that up on another meeting where I was like, I actually don't think a lot of people know what producers do. And that's why there's always,
we're just figuring it out ourselves.
No, Janet, thank you for bringing that up. If anyone is brave enough and wants to give a quick, you know, bird's eye view summary of what it is that you all do for anyone who may be like new to this, yeah, please.
Well, I think we start out by finding usually, okay, in every situation that we find material. Some people think all we do is fund projects. Far from it. We look for funding. We hold out our tin cup. And usually, I think most of the people on this call are that way. Sometimes we have our own funding, but it's everything and anything. So it starts with finding the material. And that can come in the way of a book or an article or a script or a relationship with a director who has a, you know, an idea or whatever it may be. And it's like building something from nothing. Like you start with nothing. And you somehow grow it so it becomes something. And, you know, it's be anything, but it's how to build that organism to so that it can eventually get made and be seen by other people. So it's finding the director in some cases, finding a writer, finding cast, finding something, finding a piece of IP, finding it's like whatever, all the pieces that come together to create a whole. So much we could say about that.
I don't know if this makes sense. And Janet, please correct me if I'm not making any sense, but it's almost like you're like a project director. So you're the person in charge of hiring a lot of the people that are like, if you're going to build a building, right? You have to find an architect, find the contractor, find the person to interior design and find somebody to figure out like where, like the plumbing and all this stuff. So it's kind of like, a lot of times I feel like producers kind of come up with a vision or help come up with a vision, find directors if there's not one, or find writers to adapt a piece of IP if you found something that you've gravitated towards, and then in conjunction with the director and the rest of the people involved, fill out the staff, and you're involved in the casting. I mean, at least that's the creative producers primarily do that and find funding. And you usually see a project from sort of inception or early days all the way through production, post marketing, distribution, and like the DVD cover.
Anything anyone would like to add?
If you're good at your job, nobody will ever talk about you. And if the movie sucks, then you get blamed for it. It's
And as far as somebody asked about books, there is a book called So You Want to, there aren't that many books, So You Want to Be a Producer. And then somebody literally just reached out recently, a woman who used to be a agent/manager, Carol Baum. And she just wrote a book. She literally said, will you please talk about this book? She didn't even know it was going to be on the Zoom, but I teach sometimes. So she wants me to recommend her book. I haven't seen it yet. Carol Baum, Baum. And there are a few other books about producing. And there's just a lot online. You're all very lucky that you can get so much information by doing research online. We didn't have that when I was growing up.
Well, now that everyone is crystal clear in what it is that you all do and all the nuances, I'm going to jump into some questions for each of you, and then we'll come back to some group questions, but just to try to dig a little bit deeper into the projects and the works that you have each done. I'm going to start with you, Michael, just because you're furthest away. So Beasts of the Southern Wild, I think I'm sure it gets brought up often. It's because it was made so unconventionally. It was done by a grassroots group of artists, mostly untrained actors, a lot of young children. How did you balance the need for, you know, a professional, healthy working environment, allowing raw naturalism and also spontaneity while, you know, making a movie that is like so complex, with so many moving parts?
Yes, it took a lot of time and a lot of work and development. And, you know, it's a lot about listening to what is the most important to the director, and like kind of formatting your plan around that. I mean, that's, we talked about what a producer is, and it's also like what you should do as a producer is, I think it was Andrew said, like, what does this project need of me? It's also like, what what can we do? What does this director need to pull off the vision that they want, and prioritizing that? So, you know, there, it would have been different if it had been, if we had like, just like a very quick prep and then went right into shooting. I don't think we would have been so, I think things would have been not as planned, but like we were developing the movie for a solid year before we even went into real prep. And then at that point, we had done a lot of research about, you know, child labor laws and making sure that we were completely in line with it. And then also, I mean, time also gives you a lot of chance to really, I don't know, gain people's trust, because we were in a community that was mostly not ours. And we just established relationships for a long, long period of time. And our casting process was very intensive, and we saw people who were in the, who ended up being in the movie many, many times and formed relationships with them. And so by the time it was like, okay, it's time to go and make this crazy movie, like on the fringe of the bayou, like we kind of were just clear about how wild it was going to be. And they knew that we were, I don't know, they trusted us enough to kind of go with it. And then you just gotta be, you know, you just gotta be in close touch with everybody's parents, especially in terms of kids, and be really, really, I don't know, just being honest with them about what we're trying to do, what is trying to be pulled off here, why it's important, you know, why the director wants it, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, time. I mean, time is the answer. Time that you take to plan and to get to know everybody really well.
As it was going, did it feel messy? Did it feel like there was
Oh, sure.
Totally. Yeah, you're concerned as you were in it.
I mean, concern is, you know, it felt like messy and chaotic, but I don't know if I ever felt like I never felt like we put anybody in danger or anything like that. You know, it just felt the chaos of like, it's your first movie. It was not a SAG movie. It was a lot of untrained actors, which means that, you know, like your shooting day doesn't go like a normal shooting day. I now have come to understand does go. You know, you're setting up lighting so that the actors can move around the entire set as much as they want, because that's the kind of like, what, that's why you hired them, for this naturalism, for the ability to go wherever they want to go and for you to capture it. So all of that added up to a crazy schedule that got changed a bunch, not to mention that the BP oil spill happened on day one of photography while we were in,
you know,
while we were there. So that threw a wrench in things too. But trying to control the chaos as much as you can is part of the process with Ben.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Christina, I'll come over to you, because I read in some interviews that you mentioned the personal connection that you have to Minari. Is that pronounced correctly?
Kind yeah.
Minari. and the connection to the immigrant story. How did your relationship to the material affect the producing process on this particular film? And if anyone wants to chime in after, just in terms of you know, your personal story impacting the work that you're doing, please feel free.
My parents came over in the early 80s, and I was a child of immigrants, and they worked really hard to build this life for themselves in what they, you know, what they were preached to be the American dream, right? So when I read this script, it was for the first time I was like, oh my God, this is kind of like a weirdly, you know, I didn't grow up on a farm or in the Midwest, and my parents didn't have the exact same job. The spirit of the film was very, felt very familiar to me. Like these two people that had these kids, we were sort of welcomed, but also not, like a little ostracized. I grew up in a very white, predominantly white neighborhood in Massachusetts, in a small town. But my parents had kind of floated around all over Boston, and I think even New York prior to my birth, and really sort of figured out how to make a living for themselves and you know, they came with nothing. And within 10 years of being here, when I was born, like, I don't remember ever feeling like I was living in like a very, you know, poor, lower class neighborhood. So it's kind of remarkable about how hard they worked to sort of build this life where by the time I had, you know, come of age, I felt very much like the little Alan, little David, where I was just always in awe of like the world around me and kind of oblivious to sort of the struggles of my parents. And then as I grew older and more aware, I saw a lot of that in the script, even when they were fighting in the kitchen and the kids sort of are like, don't fight. That happened a lot. Like, you know, just the struggles of being in, you know, of having that sort of lifestyle and having that sort of background. So sort of taking that into producing the film, I kind of was like, there's key areas where I think it would be really, really helpful to have as much authenticity as possible, not to be like, oh, you know, we're Korean, we have to tell a Korean story. But I do think when it's authentic in spirit and in sort of the foundation, for an audience member, it's way easier to just get into the story and just to not be questioning whether that's real or that's not real. So I do think in the production design, in casting and in editing, I was really big on like, hey, we need to make sure I want to really try to find Korean Americans or Koreans that have experience or a deep, just inherent knowledge of what something looked like or felt like. I do think also in editing, there's really nuanced scenes where I do think if the language didn't sound good or like for Korean, for people who are bilingual or who speak Korean, it can tend to take you out of it. As a Korean speaker growing up, like you'd watch shows that had Koreans in it and it's like, you know, they cast a non-Korean, so they don't speak the language and you're just like, what? But we were very fortunate in finding, I had met Harry Yoon, who's a Korean American editor, and he's, you know, familiar with the language, and it was way easier, I think, for him to cut because he already had that background. Yong-ok, who was our production designer, was, you know, from Korea and had production design in Korea, and then also had moved over to the US to start her production designing career. And so I would walk onto the set and be like immediately transported back to like my childhood, being like, oh yeah, my parents used that weird like scooper thingy. And yeah, the bathroom always had a scrubby thing. And that bowl is very like my grandma had one. And scenes where, you know, they're bringing spices and stuff, it's like those bags are very much what my grandparents like would smuggle like chili flakes in. So it kind of like created this authentic environment that sort of gives the audience a tether to grab onto and not have to focus on anything else and just kind of let you live in that space. And I do think that was really important. And obviously casting kids who could really speak the language. And felt very much like, you know, younger versions of ourselves and the director, Isaac, Lee Isaac. And it was a big like collaboration between Lee Isaac and myself, and just wanting to really, you know, make sure we could safeguard certain aspects of it. And we got very, very, very lucky. We were very fortunate. And Julie Kim, who cast our film, was also, you know, she could pick up on whether kids were fluent or not. And that was really helpful. So we would get, you know, the picks were very specific. And
I think
that's the long-winded answer.
No, but it's really beautiful to hear your answer, because I feel like many times people have the wrong impression of a producer in a movie, and they believe that, you know, they're the money people or the logistics people. They're just looking at calendars and telling people no. But I think, at least in my experience, from what you're just mentioning right now, is like producers can have deeply personal and intimate relationships with the projects that they do. And I feel like you most certainly feel it in a movie when not only the director, but the producer and other people on the crew have that same sort of like passion for the story that's being told. So it's nice to hear you say that.
I feel compelled to talk about the word producer, because if you've noticed, There's this organization called AMPTP, American Association of Motion Picture Television Producers. Those producers are not these producers at all.
Thank you. Unfortunately,
there's a really strong distinction. I wish they would stop calling themselves producers because we're the producers, but they're financiers, distributors, studios. And back in the day, there were more producers. Now they're really more financiers and, you know, or platforms or whatever, but they continue to call themselves producers. And it's very confusing. So people may unjustifiably get mad at us because they think we're the ones that are going against, you know, their demands of the guilds. And that's so not the case. So we are independent producers, very, very different from the producers who fund multiple movies a year.
Yeah, you're bringing the truth to this panel. Would any of you want to add anything in terms of your personal relationship, sorry, your personal stories affecting the work that you've been doing or specific projects that you felt sort of like deeply connected to?
I mean, I'll just jump in and say, if you're not passionate about the subject, then I don't think it's a good idea to engage in something for other reasons, like you think it's going to make you $1 zillion or, you know, the intellectual calculation that you may make about whether or not a project is well suited to you may often go awry. Like if you don't have the deep creative personal connection to the material personally, this is how I feel. I think it's really hard to sustain the energy and the tenacity that you need to see through because you never know how long it's going to take. There's so much uncertainty on every journey of a project. So you better love it, you know, and that's what will carry through. I was just scrolling through and looking at all the millions of questions.
I love that you're answering,
I'm used to this role.
No, please.
But one thing that's that is super important is the pitch. More and more these days, you are asked to pitch a project. It could be a very brief, what they call elevator pitch, like a really brief summary of the project just to hook somebody's attention, to get their attention. And then you may have the opportunity to officially pitch it to a studio executive or a Netflix executive or whatever. And they'll give you 20 minutes to pitch. And that means really being extremely concise about what your project is and why you want to make it, telling the story. I mean, everything's, especially after the pandemic, everything's done on Zoom more or less. We used to do a lot of meetings in person. More and more things are done on Zoom. So there's this kind of intense focus on your face, your pitch. And you do generally want to have a pitch deck, a visual presentation. And you talk about the main characters, the story. And in some cases, because this is another question, you do want to give maybe comps if you feel confident about that. And the overall, so there's a lot of information. And there's a lot of information online that you can also find about creating a pitch deck, and it's become vitally important. And you may find yourself pitching to another producer just so that they can support your project, or a buyer or a financier, whatever it is. But that pitch has taken on outsized importance in our lives.
Yeah.
Number one.
No, I'm just saying it's funny because these panels that we've done, they like so many like important moments of knowledge sharing have come from it, and a panel has informed the next panel and so on. And I'm thinking that it may be a really good idea to do one of these just on pitching, because I agree with you that just the weight that pitches have taken in our careers, or it's just you just have to get really good at it, and you can't really get good at it until you do it many, many times, and sometimes it takes years. So I think it may be a good idea to look into that, Jan, and I'm glad that you brought it up.
Somebody just asked, do we have creative input? And of course it's part of the whole, like you're the glue that's holding all these pieces together. And where and when appropriate. Yes, I mean, I think it's important that in most cases that you feel like, it depends on who you're working with. So it's often very important because you're kind of keeping the glue together between the creative and the business aspects, the marketing, the budget, everything. You're looking at the big picture. And it's the creative aspect of it is, of course, very important. It's not your sole concern, though. You're looking at a 360 kind of snapshot of the whole project, where it sits in the marketplace, you know, where you might find distribution, et cetera, et cetera. So these issues come up, for instance, with casting. Like, do you go for someone that seems more authentic? In some cases, somebody might push for like, oh, but this person has a bigger, has more value in the marketplace, et cetera. There's a lot of interesting questions that come up. But if you don't have a creative instinct for the project, you're more of a line producer. You're doing like a lot of the nuts and bolts. Yeah. But as the creative producer, your creative instincts are very important.
Yeah, that's maybe a good. No. This is great. A good segue, because Andrew, you are, in addition to being a producer, you're also a creator. You, of course, do the producing work you do with Fabula, but you are also an acclaimed documentary director. And I'm curious to see how your directing and your doc work has affected the way you approach producing, because as Janet was just mentioning, producing is an highly, highly creative job. And yeah, just curious to see how those two worlds and those two very different filmmaking muscles inform each other.
I would say it certainly gives me a little more empathy for the process. You know, what it is to go through the notes process, what it is to wrestle with an edit. And I hope it gives me a little more insight into, you know, supporting that process with a filmmaker. The very practical reality is when I had a documentary that pre-COVID was making festival rounds, it allowed me to visit festivals with a different, I got invited into different rooms. I went to a different brunch, right? I got to meet filmmakers as a peer rather than as a sort of an other. And in which case I find them incredibly compatible. It was a really helpful way to see projects when I'm in the room. You know, as a filmmaker with my own project, it changes the conversation. And yeah, I think for me, it's an outgrowth of the same thing. I'm fascinated by the process of filmmaking in all respects of it. So as much as I can do both, I would love to do both. But what I have found just in my own life is that producing tends to be sort of an all-consuming job. It's hard to carve out space for side projects. You know, it is essential in helping me keep the interest or passion alive for the process is probably the short answer.
Are you still active as a filmmaker? You jump back and forth?
There are certainly projects that are on a longer time horizon now. Let's put it that way. They're working, but enough in front of us right now to deal with that. It might be a minute.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Poppy, I got a question for you. As we were talking about a little bit earlier, I think this is like the third or fourth panel that we've been in together, which is amazing. But I'm just curious, why is it important for you to talk about your work and your process in a way that lets people into your world as much as you do? And I guess even more specifically, you know, what is your philosophy on sharing knowledge with future generations, filmmakers, producers? It seems like you've really prioritized these opportunities. So just so curious to hear where that's coming from.
I'm a giver. I mean, like it's a community, and anywhere that I can be helpful, I will be helpful. It's, you know, if people want to hear what I have to say and they think it's valuable, I'm happy to sit. I'm kind of wired that way. There can be a line that I have to draw, because sometimes it gets a little, you know, less me and more them. But I think it's important. I think it's important to be collaborative. I think there's, you know, new relationships and new ideas to be had. I have sat with a lot of up and coming producers who even sometimes I may not even remember what I said or did, and later come back as a successful someone who has completed their films and is really on the rise. And like, that thing you said, and I'm just like, oh my God, you know, great. And I had people who believed in me, there was a time when I was directing and I had somebody who was like, I like the cut of your jib, and I was still in school, and they were like, come direct this Interscope music video. And I was somehow a film student, talked to the record company into a crane and 35 millimeter on the side of a mountain in Chatsworth. So how can I not like continue to, you know, reach back? And I think particularly, you know, with filmmakers of color, there isn't a lot of mentorship. There isn't a lot of people who are really dedicated to telling their stories. And, you know, I just want to see everybody, like, let's all go rise with the tide.
Yeah. And just say it one more time. Thank you all for doing this. I know it means, I'm, you know, quickly glancing over the chat, I know it means a lot to everyone here. So thank you. Okay. We're going to move on to the Q&A section of our evening. I'm going to just have a few questions here. Feel free to anyone who wants to jump in, you know, I'll encourage you to keep your answers brief so that we can get through as many of these as possible. Okay, speed round. Producers, particularly in independent spaces, are often expected to fall on their sword for a production in ways that are neither sustainable mentally nor financially. What types of standards or safety nets do you think you need to put in place in order to protect and advocate for yourself in the same way that producers are expected to do so for everyone else? That's a very long but very eloquent question. How do you take care of yourself?
I would jump onto that and say that Rebecca Green has been spearheading a producers union with the idea of building a set of like industry-wide standards and things we can agree on. And there's a lot to be read about that, but I think there's sort of a professional standard that I think we can try to hold to and hold financiers to, depending on who's asking you to fall on which sword. But emotional support one really is about building a support network of people, knowing where your limits are and knowing when you can, you know, when you can say no to a thing. But a lot of that comes from having a supportive network on your own that means you don't have to get it from the movie or project.
Anyone else? Producer, self-care?
I was just going to say, I also don't think there's any harm, or actually I find benefit in having producing partners. This was something that I was going to bring up earlier to another question in terms of like kind of your role. But as it relates to the filmmaker, but I think I have found a lot of value in having partners and, you know, with people with different types of skill sets and strengths, and we all kind of complement each other and become the Voltron producer. And that can be you with the line producer, that can be you with an executive producer. But there is a way to kind of share and everyone have their lane, not meaning that you're siloed, because I think there's a lot of places that will for sure overlap and you're united in the vision of the movie and wanting to support the filmmaker. But I think don't be afraid of that. Like it just has to be just you driving that ship.
That's great advice.
I was just going to ask her something. This is very practical too. Somebody asked about how do you protect your material. Anybody can submit to the Writers Guild a script or a treatment, and they will assign. I mean, it's protected that way. They will assign a number, and so you don't have to worry. And if there was ever the possibility that the idea was getting stolen, they would look at your draft and the other one, et cetera, et cetera. So you should know that.
I think it's really free, right? It's free.
It's a nominal fee, I believe.
Back in the day, it was a couple. Yeah, you can go to WGA and protect your work.
I think it's like
$25
or something like that.
Okay. Also, you can watermark stuff or send it via secure link too.
Okay, when making the jump from micro to higher budget, higher profile productions, what advice do you have for leveling up as a producer?
I'm going to echo what Poppy just said about partners. one way to level up is find someone who's done it before and do what you can to support the project and learn from who you're working with.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. It's you never stop learning. I to this day I went from doing tiny movies and slightly bigger movies to doing television, and which is a whole other beast of, you know, it's like 8 hours of stuff versus, you know, two, and you have a way larger crew and more directors and more voices. And I do think having a partner that you can rely on, or at least like other executives or other executive producers or producers, is helpful. But it's also just being very open to learning and growing and learning from others who, you know, you don't have to do it all yourself. You can continuously learn. There's no cap to that.
I saw a quick, what about the producer pool, since we're on this topic? And yeah, that's a thing. You know, don't invite 25 people to your party. It will get diluted. But I think it's like you're weighing the pros and cons and you're figuring out your deals and what you can be comfortable. Also depending on who's really going to be boots on the ground versus someone who's calling in support versus, you know, it goes back to the role in that partnership and kind of coming to that accord. But yeah, you have to think about that.
Michael, I was going to bring it back to you because I know that you're recently, some directors that you've worked with doing like very, very independent productions, you know, like as independent as it gets, now you've gotten a chance to work with those same directors on, you know, bigger profile, bigger scope, bigger budget projects. Are there any sort of like big takeaways that you've had in your recent experiences?
A really good line producer is really important as you scale up with the director that you've worked with before. One that understands the director's vision and what is a priority to them and what is not. But that's another version of saying, like, don't be scared to, you know, partner with people who have done it before so that they can help you help the director kind of graduate up and you know, make the canvas bigger. So, yeah. And what else? Yeah, just like don't be scared of partners if they're value added in filling in the blanks that you don't know about. Don't like tell yourself that you know how to do something that you've never done before, because you don't. That's simple.
I would put 5 exclamation points on that line producer part. Someone who can
likewise.
Yeah.
What was a risk you've taken based completely on a gut instinct that resulted in being wildly successful? If any of you have any that just come to mind, sometime where, you know, reason or colleagues would have advice against and you stuck to your gut and it paid off.
I was a baby producer and I was presented with the galley to a novel that at the time was nameless, but eventually became the Joy Luck Club. It was 3 discrete chapters that weren't even connected, but I just thought I have to do this because it's so close to my life and I hadn't read anything like it, but it broke every rule in the book because it was no white people in the cast, more or less. It was a good chunk of it was in a non-English language. It had a lot of flashbacks. It had 3 generations back and forth. It broke every rule, but I was too naive to know that. And fortunately, it got made. Sometimes you just have to dive in. I think these days people may relish the independence. It was made by a studio, by the way, which again would not happen today. So you have to be sensitive to what's going on in the marketplace, what the tastes are. In that period of time, in the mid 90s, it was possible to present a project like that to a studio. And then you might have that one executive, in this case, Jeffrey Katzenberg, who would shine a light on it when everybody else says no. But you'd have to really do your homework and see who's buying what. What are they, you know, what's going on? You know, what's going on out there? What are the companies? So that would be my advice. But it was a complete shot in the dark. And like, what was I thinking? I don't know. But
and sometimes that's how you make the best decisions, right? With naivete. Anyone else wants to share any gut reaction moments that paid off?
Mine's very similar to Janet's. Like, Minari was like a script that was primarily in Korean, but it was written in English. So we kind of like pulled one over on the financiers. Because it was like everything in italics is in Korean. And when you're reading it, you kind of forget. But I would almost say every movie feels like a little bit of a gamble. You never know if it's going to pay off, or if you've never worked with the filmmaker before, or even if you have, you just never know. The marketplace changes so quickly now, and movies take a minute. So by the time I shoot something and it comes out, I don't know, like the world could be a totally different space. So I do think in lieu of that, you kind of just have to focus and just pour yourself into the thing at present, and kind of drop any sort of ego or whatever about expectations or whatever, and just really, you know, give yourself to that project that you've committed yourself to at that moment. And oftentimes I do find and see over and over again, not just in myself, but my peers who also produce because they're super passionate about something, it does end up finding its audience, or, you know, at least producing some great work of art that will live in our zeitgeist forever, hopefully.
Maybe, sorry to bother you, although I think we all were just kind of like, let's see what happens. I think, you know, Macro was just coming off of Fences and Mudbound, and we're really stuck in this box of people thinking we only want to do true, like, period stories that dealt with racial conflict. And we were really, and Nina Yang brought us Sorry to Bother You, and we trust and revere Nina above and beyond, and she has the most impeccable taste. So that had us leaning in immediately. But, you know, around page 70, a little something happens, and the script takes a hard left. And we were just like, we're not sure, you know, people, it's either going to catapult out of the stratosphere or go down in flames. And we felt like at least people will know we took a swing. And that was the risk that we took. And there were some younger folks in the company, they're like, I'm going to quit if you don't make this movie. And then there were some other people that are like, I'm scared, but I love it. So let's see.
I'm glad you guys took the chance. I will say that one piece of advice somebody gave me once that I still think about today is, if you feel like you're going to die if you don't make something, maybe you should make it.
How can you make sure that you're being supportive to a director but not overstepping on their role creatively? And again,
I have a thing about this, which I was going to say this earlier, but it didn't quite fit into any of what we were saying. But like, if you as a producer are hearing a director's pitch and you think like, I personally creatively can make this better, I don't recommend that. Like, if you think I can help this direct, I believe in this director, I believe in this team, if there's a team in place, and I think that I can help them figure out how to make it better, and that's really exciting, that's like a project that you should work on. But I think if you're thinking to yourself, like, I know exactly what this needs and I'm going to make sure it does, I'm going to make sure that we do that. And if we do that, then I know that I will be really excited about this movie. Then like, you're not, I would recommend second guessing yourself there, because I don't think that that's really how it works. And maybe you actually want to be a director or something, I don't know.
That's great advice.
I think I saw that question in the chat actually, and was thinking back on the time you know, on Last Black Man in San Francisco, that was Joe's first feature, and it was my first also, like, completely taking the producing reins on something on my own in a different, you know, city. I do think it's a very collaborative thing, and you kind of have to find your own rhythms with the director, especially if you've never worked with them before. But there is a way to speak on, I do think on a certain level, there has to be a level of honesty between you and your filmmaker where, you know, because it does get pretty emotional or intense when you're up against the clock, you have 3 days before you start principal and something happened. And a lot, oftentimes I find people are too afraid to speak to each other about something difficult. So then you leave it to some last minute and everyone freaks out. But I do think oftentimes, I know it's hard, but being honest and open and creating that line of communication with your director will lead to a relationship where you're not overstepping on each other. And instead, as Michael said, you're sort of helping guide people or helping them make better decisions. And sometimes you have to push a little bit to be like, hey, we really have to make this decision today, but there's a way to do it respectfully. And your responsibility, I feel, at least this is my tenet of how I feel like I produce, is like, you do really are meant to be there to help and create space for your director. And whether that's, you know, sometimes pushing them a little or taking a step back, it's kind of, you'll figure it out.
I think I found it almost different depending on the filmmaker also, of like what that collaboration looks like. You know, there definitely, I've worked with more seasoned and then like super fresh. And depending on how you're working with them, how they're bringing you in, what they're asking you to weigh in on, like there's a lot of the technical stuff that you're going to be handling in terms of department heads and that kind of stuff. But I think creatively, to Christina's point of like, you'll find your language and how that will work. And I think as long as you're operating with respect, that will go a long way. Instead of coming in and like forcing your vision, I think it should be this. I think that's going to close some doors, but yeah. It's also, I think, not always there. You can present ideas also of like, your filmmaker may not take them, but at least you can challenge them to think outside the box, and present options in a way that I think can still be respectful and enhance vision or enhance intent or give them just other things to think about, because it is that collaboration.
Yeah. Thank you all so much. We're at OT. Just to close it up, if and when someone makes a biopic of your lives, who would you want to direct? Who would you want to star playing you? Michael, you go first.
No, what? Carlos, what kind of a question to just drop on me? I have no idea. Somebody else go first.
Great.
I can't answer that.
I think I hear people needing me in the other.
Okay, I gotta jump now. See you.
3:30 a.m. in Italy. I gotta go.
Thank you for joining. Time's up.
I will drive.
You're going to overtime.
On all of you. Thank
Ryan
you
all. Gosling. I would love Ryan Gosling to play me.
Thank you all so much for taking the time and sharing a little bit of your brains with us. Thanks for everyone who joined. Much appreciated. See you all very soon.
Bye everyone.
Bye everyone.
Andrew, Dan, Bob, Michael, Christina.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Many thanks once again to Carlos for organizing and moderating that incredible conversation, and to Christina, Poppy, Michael, Andrew, and Janet for joining us and participating. If you enjoyed this program, please stay tuned. We will be bringing more of the Anti-Gravity Academy satellite sessions in the coming weeks. But if you'd like to tune in live and contribute some questions of your own, be sure to follow Anti-Gravity Academy online. You can find that link in our show notes. And if you'd like even more conversations with artists and filmmakers about how they use technology to tell their stories, please be sure you are subscribed to us, the Dolby Institute podcast. You can find links to our show on all the major podcasting platforms, including the video version on YouTube, in our show notes. Or you can simply search for Dolby wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're curious to know more about the Dolby Institute, head on over to dolbyinstitute.com. There you'll find information about all of our programs. You can access the entire library of episodes of this podcast, and you can sign up for our mailing list. Until next time, thanks again for joining us. This is the Dolby Institute podcast. I'm your host, Glenn Kaiser. Our producer and editor is Michael Coleman. Our executive producers are Amanda Schneider and Jack Ferry, with additional editing by Matt Nixon. Thank you for listening.